you're sick of hearing the anti-white message, then you've come to the right place. You're tuned in to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Traditionalist. Today's date is Friday, the 26th of May, 2017. It's 12 o'clock American time and it's 5 o'clock British time. It's a beautiful sunny day outside today and I'm hoping my guest today has been having a good day out in the sunshine as well. Messerschmitt, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm doing quite well, thanks. Summer has finally arrived here. It's a really beautiful weather. There's not a single cloud in sight. And I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, I'd love to be able to see Switzerland in the summertime up the top of those mountains and those glaciers. It's an absolutely beautiful country that you have there. And today we were going to really talk. It was really going to concentrate on you and how you came to nationalism and maybe a little bit about your country. A lot of people have been saying they'd really like to hear more from you. I know we did a podcast quite a while back, a Homeland Report, where you were talking about Switzerland, and we had lots of technical problems with
Indeed.
That. Yeah, and we've certainly improved our technical proficiency since then. And it would be good to just hear about how you came to nationalism, how you came to find out about the lies that we've been taught about race and how you, but I mean, because it's a pretty brave thing to go against all the programming and support National Socialism, which I know that you have done, and you come out with these fantastic Axis War Hero series that you've done, talking about these amazing men from the Second World War that were actually fighting on the other side of my country and your country. So I'd really like to hear about where that courage came from and what it was that got you to change your mind. What were you like before you were a nationalist? I don't believe you were always a nationalist, because I think only about 1% of us were actually brought up in nationalist families. So were you an extreme liberal, an anarchist, or were you just a normal materialistic sort of person? What were you like when you were younger, Schmidt, before you became a nationalist?
Well, I really have to dig back far into my memories, how it all started. I certainly didn't grow up in a nationalist family, not at all. And, I had some experiences at school. Well, first of all, I grew up in a village that was heavily diversified, but the diversity wasn't that bad as it is today, because it was mostly guest workers from Yugoslavia, from Italy, these kinds of people. So they were white. I remember only seeing one Negro in my village until I was perhaps 14 or 15 or so. And it has changed a lot since then. Well, one of the experiences at school was also that we had this sort of art fair going on, and people were praising what looked to me like just a smeared paint on a wall. And I just said, this isn't art. This is not art to me. And then I think it was the art teacher or someone near an adult said, well, this is art, and you can't go down that line. I'm, of course, paraphrasing from 30 years ago or more. So I don't have an exact memory of that dialogue, but it was something like, you can't go down that line, because if you say this is not art, then you're getting very dangerously close to the people who talk about degenerate art, and we all know where that leads and so on. But that didn't impress me. I just couldn't call that art what I saw, because, I mean, art to me has to do with skill. And someone without good skills at whatever, painting, sculptures, drawing, cannot be a good artist. And art to me has to serve a function, whether that be to simply bring joy, you know, like a painting showing a beautiful landscape, can enhance your room, for example, visually, or whether that be to teach something like you know, a story can have a moral, and I guess a painting, for example, can also teach you something. But in any case, it has to serve a function that serves some purpose and is good for the people, for society.
Art should uplift the soul. There is an objective beauty, and there is proportions to things. This is a thing that I don't know whether it's just because we are white and therefore I find the white form beautiful. I don't think this is correct, because blacks find the white form beautiful, obviously. Chinese do. They all wish to breed with white people. So they, as the object of beauty, the most beautiful human being is the white human being. And it's not just because of the extreme whiteness, the blonde hair and the blue eyes in the extreme example of a white woman. It's also the proportions. We have certain proportions to us. You can see this particularly in Donald Trump with the golden section, which is, I think it's the number 2 to 5. And 3 is the ratio between them. And then you can increase that again. So you can go from 2 to 5 to 8 and then and keep going. And that in a rectangular shape. I'm probably not explaining it very well. But that's the golden proportion. And this golden proportion is reflected in the human body, especially in the white human body. So we have objective beauty and its proportion. And when I look at mulattoes and mixed race people, all their proportions are all mixed up. They look odd. Even if they don't have dark skin, they will look odd. And it's because their proportions aren't right. The head will be the wrong size for the body, or the legs will be the wrong length for the body, or the chest will be the wrong length for the body. And it's all to do with proportion. And with artwork, there's a beauty to just getting the proportion right. This is why we love architecture so much, especially, or I do, Gothic architecture. And it's all to do with the proportions. And when you look at modern art, it's all about pulling everything out of proportion. So it just seems ugly to me. And yet we're told we must support this because it's not white people that have created it. I've seen negresses smearing cow dung around into what's supposed to be the Mother Mary, and we're supposed to say that this is art, this is beautiful, and they get a pass just purely because they're black. And I've had a similar experience to you, Schmidt. I used to think about breeds. I used to think, well, we have certain breeds of dog that are good for certain things. I wonder if there are certain types of man. There must be certain types of man that are good for certain tasks. And maybe that's what the caste system was about before. And I remember saying about this to a friend of mine, and him saying, oh, you can't get involved in that. You can't be interested in that. That's racism. And I thought, what's that got to do with hating other races? Surely it would be good to find out what type of people are the best at doing what tasks, and then give them that education to do that. And he said, oh, no, that's racism. That leads to the Nazis. And I couldn't work out at the time how that could lead to racism or Nazis. I just thought, surely there must be a physical type of person that would be good at carrying out certain tasks. But of course that's a politically incorrect area to move into. So you were ostracized, really, or told, no, you can't go, you can't say things like that, Schmidt. You can't look at things in that way when you were young. So you were troubled by this. So how did you get from being troubled by that to getting in contact with us at Radio Aryan and coming on these shows and talking to the public like we are now? How did you get from the young lad that was troubled at seeing the messy artwork and being told that he couldn't appreciate beauty without supporting Nazis, to standing up for National Socialism and nationalism now?
Well, as they say, hindsight is 20/20, and it's kind of hard for me to differentiate between what I know now, what I think now, and my experiences and how they affected me and what really was the process that led to me finding nationalism. Well, let me think for a moment. Well, I never fell for cultural Marxism. That one is for certain. And I think me being Catholic had something to do with that. But actually, I wasn't raised Catholic in any strict sense, not at all. In fact, from all my extended family, I mean, the closer family, like cousins and parents and all that, I was probably the only one that really fully went into Catholicism and read about it and thought about it a lot. So maybe that was kind of a firewall that prevented me from ever getting into these degeneracies and cultural Marxism. And as I said, there were all these foreigners around. And by the way, they used to call them guest workers back then. That was one of the ways that they baited us with. I'm not sure. Did they call them guest workers at first in Britain when they first started to bring in these people?
Oh, yeah. So yeah, they would tell us that they were doing the jobs that we didn't want them to do, and we were lazy, and there was too much work, and we had to bring these people in. And then we were told that we had to bring them in because we needed to feel sorry for them. They were fleeing from war. Now we're told we just need to bring them in just because they haven't got enough money in their own countries. And we've gone from being told that they're doing the jobs that we don't want them to do to being told that we have to replace white people in all the top jobs with these people that we were told originally came here just to do the jobs that we didn't want to do. We have them replacing the weathermen. We have them replacing the newsreaders. We have them replacing the shadow foreign secretary in the Labour Party. We have quotas at the BBC saying that a certain amount of people that the BBC employs as actors and actresses have to be Negroes, or they have to be Pakistanis. Now, being a TV actor, being a TV actress, being a celebrity, that is a job that everyone wants to do. That's not a job that the British people don't want to do. They're too lazy to do. That's something that everyone wants to be. I mean, when I was a child, I used to want to be a train driver. Half the train drivers are now all black. When you're a kid, you want to be a bus driver. The bus drivers are all black in London. So the reasons for why we must accept immigration have changed over the years, and I suspect they were exactly the same over there in Switzerland for you, Schmidt. And
yes, exactly. I think we have a very similar story, our countries, in this. So, well, I saw all these foreigners around me, and they were in class at school. I think about half of them were foreigners. But I didn't, well, you know, as a child, you just more or less accept the situation as it is. I didn't know that my parents, or never thought about it, that my parents went to school into classes with nothing but Swiss children. This is just the sort of world I was put into. I was born into, and I didn't have all that many problems with the foreigners. I was on good terms with most of them, and again, as I said before, it's kind of hard for me to differentiate whether I already thought that back then or whether this is me with the knowledge I have now. But I did realize that the foreigners were usually the alphas among the boys. And I think, well, thinking back, I think this has a lot to do with, these boys were getting told by their parents that they have to be manly, that they have to fight and not take any insult from anyone. And what they told us, more or less, the Swiss boys, was that, oh, you have to be peaceful, you have to never get into a fight, you have to discuss and use words to defend yourself. And well, that works if there's only Swiss people around and there's no external war going on or anything like that, then you can live in harmony and peace like that. But there's just this it kind of brings an imbalance. And so yeah, the foreigners were usually the alphas in the class. And I also noticed that actually the Swiss boys started to talk with a foreign accent, if you can believe that. They started to imitate the foreign boys. And
these were white foreigners, were they, that you were saying?
Yes, they were. There were no Asians, no, they were all Europeans, Eastern Europeans mostly, or Southern Europeans. But still, there was a noticeable difference.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear, because I mean, it's progressed so badly now that it's Negroes and Pakistanis, but it just started off with other whites being foreigners. This is a problem that we've had over the last 10 years in Britain, is with the influx of European foreigners. We've got half as many European foreigners as we have non-white foreigners. But I'd far rather have the European ones if it was a choice made between the two. But Switzerland is now getting filled up with the non-whites as well, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I just read that we have 20,000 Eritreans, and there's absolutely no reason for these people to be here. There have been fact-finding missions to Eritrea, and they found out that things are not really that bad. But that doesn't change anything, because our traitor politicians want them here no matter what. And it even came out that some of these people who have asylum status, they go back to Eritrea on vacation. They fly there and then come back again, if you can believe that. It's so insane, but that's what's happening.
And they're supposed to be in Switzerland fearful for their lives if they go back to Eritrea, political persecution. Yeah, it's fine to go over there for a holiday, no doubt taking lots of Swiss francs with them that are going to be worth a fortune over there in Eritrea, or just taking euros over there from what they've managed to earn in Switzerland and take away from the Swiss people. I'm surprised to hear that this was just in a village that you were brought up in, and yet there was so much of a foreign element in that village. And it does make a huge difference being brought up among your own people. I mean, where I live is fairly rural, and I see the kids' school, the primary school, they're all white faces, and they're just so lucky to be growing up among their own kind and not have half the class filled with people that hate them that speak another language. We've got schools in Britain now that speak four or five different languages. They have to have interpreters. In the schools, we've got schools where you won't find a white face in the school, and yet we are still the ones that are having to pay for that, for the education of these foreigners in a different language. It's shocking, but there are still little outposts where you can still find enclaves of white people, and I just hope and pray that they wake up to what's happening to the rest of the country and realize just how lucky they are to have their children being brought up in a homogenous community. So how did you come across nationalism? Was it a slow, gradual process then? You started out as a traditional Catholic. You had that, as you say, that firewall which protected you from the degenerate cultural Marxism. But Catholicism is very universal towards the other races, isn't it? I mean, the Pope is ultra-friendly to the other races, saying we should open the borders. And although there is a strain in Catholicism which is traditional, which we do support, the majority of it is extremely universalist. So how did you come from being a bit a traditionalist, being against the degeneracy, the abortion, the cultural Marxism, to moving to realizing the truth about race, and that this is all an attack on the white race, that our enemies are trying to genocide us? How did you come to that realization?
Well, first, the village I grew up in was heavily industrialized after World War II. There were factories built, and then they brought in these so-called guest workers. So, I think it had a lot to do with me being interested in history. And sooner or later, of course, I came across what happened in World War II. And I, of course, on TV, they had nothing but these absolutely ridiculous and lying so-called documentaries about World War II. And something just didn't sit right with me, but I couldn't really point my finger to it because I didn't know enough, but something just didn't seem right. And the more I researched, and this was before the internet, the more I researched, the more I thought that we're not getting told the full story here. And then later, when the internet came about, I researched more, and of course I had more material available to me. And then I came across people like Ernst Zündel, and at first I was kind of scared. I have to admit, to even go to his site. But I thought, well, let's see what he has to say. And so I got into contact with material about what really happened in World War II. And then I also I was interested in aviation and military aviation. And so I also started reading about these German pilots in World War II. And they didn't seem evil in the slightest to me. You know, in some of these reports, they are quoted and there are stories told, what they went through, how they talked to each other. And it seemed to me that, first of all, they really believed in what they were doing. It wasn't like that they were getting ordered from the top and threatened with imprisonment and execution if they didn't fight well. And I also learned that in the Soviet Union, that's what they did. They had these commissars behind the lines and edging on the troops and shooting them if they didn't attack or if they went backwards. So, yeah, all of that, I guess it kind of snowballed, because the more I learned, the more I researched, the more I wanted to know, and the more sources I looked at. And then very much later, of course, I came across the absolutely brilliant documentary by Dennis Weiss, Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. And I guess that also made a lot of things just click into place. I understood more and more of what was happening. And I'm still learning, of course. I'm still getting amazed by things I find out. And yeah, then there was this this night in New Year's Eve in Cologne, where all these German women were raped and groped and had their belongings stolen. And even before that, I knew that the media was heavily controlled and didn't tell us really the truth, but. Yeah, that was sort of a catalyst for me, because I got so angry that because the media tried to hide it for days, only because the story broke on social media, where they eventually forced to report on it. And of course, at first, we don't want to jump to conclusions. Maybe it was Germans raping German girls and so on. And yeah, I got so angry that. I just thought I have to do something. And I was listening to, because I like the documentary, The Greatest Story Never Told, so much. I was listening to Truth Without Radio. I listened to every episode. And then you mentioned the chat room in there. So when I had this anger, I thought, let's go there and see what the people in there are like and what they are saying. And I had a friendly reception there, and people were like-minded, and we also have a lot of fun in there sometimes. And then I wanted to ask Dennis, well, whether he knows about these German war heroes and the amazing feats they accomplished. And well, actually, my sort of plan was to have Dennis make another documentary on these war heroes, but he was busy with communism by the back door. And then you told me to come on air and talk about these war heroes. And that I did, even though public speaking is really not something that comes natural to me. But I thought I have to do something. And if this is my niche that I can help, where I can make people aware of what really happened in World War II, then so be it. And so I plucked up my courage and went on the air.
Well, we're very pleased that you did. I had an idea that you must have known a little bit more about this than you let on. Obviously, finding out about these German war heroes before you really came across the revisionist history and before you came across Dennis's documentary. When you finally saw Dennis's documentary, that must have seem like that's the final piece in the jigsaw puzzle that explains the reason why these Germans supported Hitler so much, why they were willing to risk their lives, and what they were fighting for, and how they were really fighting against communism and to protect Europe from the Bolshevik hordes. That was the reason for all the Waffen-SS. I mean, there's so much in that documentary series that explains so much of why the world is the way that it is today. And you must have seen some of the racial stuff alongside of it and thought, well, this is a bit racist. And then you finally, you saw what happened in Cologne and realized that we're speaking the truth. This is what's happening to the white race, and all the crimes against us are being covered up. And that was a really, I think that was a watershed moment for a lot of people, that attack in Cologne, because it was just huge, wasn't it? I think it was 1,000 white women that were sexually assaulted. And at first they covered the whole thing up, and then they said, oh, a few were assaulted. A few might have had their bags stolen. But at the final count, I think it was about 1,000 white women. And it wasn't just in Cologne either, was it? It was in a lot of cities in Europe. And then that same year, we discovered that the same thing had been happening at the Swedish pop festivals. The pop festivals that the 16-year-old, 17-year-old Swedish kids go to. They'd all been invaded by these immigrants, groping them and playing their ficky-ficky game, gang rape. When they all go around in a circle, and the ones on the outside will keep any white people from getting in. And in the middle of the circle, you've got a group of Pakistanis, Muslims, Negroes, and they're all trying to rape the women that they've got in the middle, or the girls that they've got in the middle, the teenagers. And the Swedish police, again, they covered all this up. They hid all of this. There was a complete media blackout on it. It's going on right the way across Europe. And it's rare that it does actually get into the newspapers, but they just couldn't hide it. If you've got 1,000 white girls that are being sexually assaulted on New Year's Eve in the middle of Europe, in Cologne, outside Cologne Cathedral, I mean, that was a big, I think that was a big symbolic part of it as well, Schmidt, was the fact that it was outside a Christian cathedral that they did this. And that part didn't get highlighted, because they were still trying to cover up the religious aspect of it, because it's a racial aspect, the fact that it's non-white races that are doing this, and it's a religious aspect to it as well, because the majority of them are Muslim, and Islam is the religion that comes from their racial soul. So I'm really pleased that you did come and get in contact with us, Schmidt, and I think your presenting skills have definitely improved. You've got a really good voice for radio. A lot of people say that. And I know, I think someone from the chat room the other day was asking whether you would do a spot of narration for them. And we've got Okuma 10 in the chat room at the moment, and he's just commenting on when I was talking about the schools a while back, and he's saying, wow, that yes, those kids are extremely lucky. Now he's in East Europe, and he has the problems with the gypsies. He knows what the gypsies are like in his schools. And that's, I'm guessing, is probably what it was like for you with these guest workers, because I suspect some of them would have been gypsies and more likely to be gypsy types if they were working in the factories rather than doing the high powered business jobs. So just working in factories is low skilled. So I should imagine they were almost like the gypsies that Okuma has to put up with. I don't know if you want to make a comment on that at all, or anything else that we've discussed in the podcast so far, Schmidt.
Coming back to Cologne, I think we should never forget that this was one big event, but this happens every day, every single day in all of Europe. It happens, and this was just because so many women were raped in the same location at the same time, that they had to report on it. But don't forget, this happens every single day in all our countries. And just the other day, there was another case in Austria where a 15-year-old girl was gang raped by three half Negroes, whatever they were, so-called asylum seekers. And they covered it up. The press didn't report on it until there was the until it was brought to court, and then the public became aware of it. But there was no reporting at all. They were ordered not to report it until they had to again, basically. Yeah,
they have to actually literally be forced to. I mean, in some of these cases, it's been the Negroes themselves that have been filming it on Facebook. So, of course, the media have had to cover it. We've also got this case at the moment in Britain with Chelsea, Justice for Chelsea, who was raped, gang raped by Muslims. And the police have got all the evidence there and they've done nothing about it. The rapists are being protected by the police. Our government have become traitors, and the police that work for them have become traitors as well. They're upholding the government, who has committed all these crimes against its own people. It's not just the raping, it's the terrorism that's going on. It's just this terrorist act in Manchester, in Britain at the moment. None of this would be able to happen if our governments had not brought in all these foreigners into our countries. That's all there is to it. Our governments are enemies to the people, and they've opened up the gates to the enemies of our people. But at least people like yourself are waking up to this, Schmidt, and you've got the courage to speak out, which I really appreciate, and I know all the listeners really appreciate too. So thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We hope you have a great weekend, and I'll be back on Monday with a new edition of the Daily Traditionalist for you. So have a great weekend, and hail victory.
If you're sick of hearing the anti-white message, then you've come to the right place. You're tuned in to Radio Arian at RadioArian.com.